T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
It's time for the Funville Nye, driven by AAA, the official weekly podcast of the Richmond Flying Squirrels. Here's your host, Trey Wilson.
Hello and welcome to the debut episode of the Funville Nine, driven by AAA. My name is Trey Wilson. I'm the Director of Communications and the play-by-play broadcaster for the Richmond Flying Squirrels, and this is the brand new official podcast for the Flying Squirrels. New episodes will be available every Monday, and they will debut live on Sports Radio 910 The Fan and 105.1 FM in the Richmond region, which is, of course, typically the home for our Flying Squirrels broadcasts throughout the year. But with sports all over currently on pause while we battle this COVID-19 pandemic, of course, we do not have any games to broadcast each night, at least as of right now. And we unfortunately can't be with you every night at the Diamond. But while we await baseball's return, the Flying Squirrels are still here for you. If you're missing the taste of your favorite ballpark foods from the Flying Squirrels games, we've launched Funville Foodie Fridays, and each week you can put in carryout orders at squirrelsbaseball.com, and we have curbside pickups at the Diamond. The Flying Squirrels have also partnered with Elephant Insurance for the Community All-Star of the Week program. If you know someone making a difference in our community, like a healthcare hero, a local police officer, or a teacher, Elephant Insurance and the Flying Squirrels would like to recognize local community all-stars who are making a positive impact during this COVID-19 pandemic. You can submit your nominations at squirrelsbaseball.com, and we'll announce a community all-star each week on social media and present them with a gift card to a local restaurant as well as a Flying Squirrels prize pack. And of course, we're here with this new podcast. A special thank you to AAA for helping make this podcast possible. We want to bring you the stories from some different Flying Squirrels players, coaches, or other figures associated with the organization. New shows will debut each week on Monday nights at 6 o'clock on Sports Radio 910 The Fan and 105.1 FM. And we'll have full extended versions of those interviews available online at thefanrichmond.com. And on the first episode of the brand new Funville 9 podcast, who else would we bring on but the Vice President, Chief Operating Officer of the Richmond Flying Squirrels, a founding member of this organization, Mr. Todd Parnell, much better known to everybody, of course, as Parney. Parney, thanks for joining us.
Hello, man. Trey. Hope everybody's doing well, and thanks for having me on this inaugural Funville 9. I love the name, and I think this is going to be a great thing for our fans to stay connected to us, and I'm looking forward to what the future brings with this and with everything else for the franchise.
So the name, the Funville 9, Anthony Opperman came up with that.
We were tossing around some ideas.
It always is. For anybody who doesn't know, it's a nod to the Mudville 9, which just do a Google search and you can look up the origin of that. Our artwork for this podcast, if you find it online, which of course will be available on thefanrichmond.com, was designed by Nick Elder, who is the creative services manager for the Richmond Flying Squirrels. Barney calls him Boy Wonder. He has incredible amounts of talent and comes up with lots of the great branding and looks of the things that you see around the Richmond Flying Squirrels. Everything from our Diaz Voladores to last year's Richmond Hush Puppies look. It helps me with my job with a lot of creative things. So you're getting a look at the logo now for the first time. It's
amazing.
It's Nick Elder work. It's a classic baseball look, isn't it?
It's amazing. It's wonderful. It was driven by our friends at AAA, which is great. And I want one of those hats that has the Funville 9 on it. That's really, really cool. You know, one of the things I'm so proud of, Trey, is just the talent that we have throughout this organization and the talent that's been bred throughout this organization over the past 10-plus seasons. And, of course, like everybody else in the world, we're going through tough times. But the talent that we have and the work ethic that we have continues to come to the forefront and rise to the top. And I'm very proud of that. That's a wonderful logo, and this whole concept of this podcast, the idea of it, the name of it, your work on it is just a tremendous thing, and I think our fan base is really going to love it.
Well, if the podcast gets popular enough, then we'll have to find a way to make those hats available in the team store here at the Diamond.
Put me down for the first 6 purchases.
You talked about the talent that's here. We talked about Anthony Opperman and his creativity coming up with the name for this and helping drive a lot of what we do promotionally with his team, and Nick Elder with the graphic assets and his creative mind. I've been here for about a year and a half now, and it's pretty evident to me that people here really put time and effort into the work that they're doing, and they give of themselves to make sure that the product that we're putting out as a whole is as good as it can be. And that really speaks to the culture of what you guys have built here over the last 10 years.
Well, you know, we came in 2009, Trey, and you know, Chuck Domino called me and asked me to come here, and I trust Chuck Domino. I trusted Chuck Domino that what he said was going to happen, and exactly what he said to me was, Lou DiBella wants us to come down here and build something special, a legacy, and I think we've done that. And it's not been one person, 2 people, 3 people, 4 people. It's been a whole town of people that were prior to the people that are here now, and there's a lot of people that have gone on to have great careers other places. Even in your seat, Trey, there's a lot of people that have filled, not a lot, but there's several people that have filled that seat that have gone on to big things, and we're really proud of that. And we always have a hashtag that we say to each other, hashtag forever squirrel, and that's the kind of environment that we try to build. And like everybody, we're not perfect, but we really try hard to have a culture that is has an insatiable appetite for success and has a fun kind of feel to it. And of course, our 3 core values are to have fun every day, to be different every day, to be impactful every day. And that's something that has really been 3 pillars that we've built everything around over the course of the last 10 plus years.
So everybody who's come to a Flying Squirrels game, even if you've only been once, you probably remember who Parney is. The guy running around like crazy on the field, catching his laundry with the crazy pants on. But I want to have an opportunity for people to get to know who Parney is outside of this, just the character that they see on the field, or the person who they might see on social media acting all kinds of crazy, and how you got to where we are here in the year 2020 in Richmond, Virginia. So you're from Locust, North Carolina.
It's between Big Lick and Frog Pond.
What was growing up in Locust like?
It's just a hee-haw town, a little Andy Griffith, Mayberry, RFD type place. I grew up in a small rancher house next to my aunt, 2 aunts and uncles. My grandfather was stood in the same spot for 49 years as a factory worker, basically, at Philcrest Cannon Towels in Kannapolis, North Carolina. I remember the buses from Kannapolis, from Philcrest Cannon, picking up my uncles and my grandfather. My grandfather actually worked second shift. My uncle Bud was a machine fixer. So that's kind of just a small town, but I was sports from the moment I popped out of my mom. I mean, I was football. I slept with a football in the wintertime. In the fall, I slept with a basketball in the wintertime. We started playing baseball. My grandpa had a 4-acre yard next to our house, and we literally mowed that into a baseball field. One time when my dad was at work, I went up and borrowed my grandpa's rototiller and actually tilled baselines in our yard and tilled a home plate in our yard. And when my dad came home, I was literally watering it like Kyle and Drew do at the Squirrels games. And let's just say that was not a good evening for my rear end, because I basically just tore up our entire backyard. But it was a nice wiffle ball field. We had a lot of nice wiffle ball games. That was the kind of childhood, you know, childhood where all the neighbor kids, Rusty Eford and Sidney Henson and Sidney Lambert and all these guys that I grew grew up with would come to our house in the summer at 9 o'clock in the morning and would play in the backyard. My mom would feed us peanut butter and jellies at noon, and then everybody would have to go home around 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night. That was repeat, 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 repeat. But my love for sports started then, and the fact that I'm now in my 31st year of working in sports in minor league baseball, it's literally a dream come true. And that's where some of the passion that you as my teammate and other people see as my teammate or our fan base sees at games or around the community, that's where a lot of that passion comes from.
So how did you get from Locust, North Carolina to, you went off to college in Pennsylvania, right?
Well, my parents moved me. It was kind of like the Clampets going to Los Angeles. My parents moved me to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania when I was 13 years old. So Trey, you mix in like the normal messed up 13-year-old boy, you know, stuff, and you take a guy from Locust, North Carolina, big fish in a small pond athletically, move him to the suburbs of Philadelphia, small fish in a huge pond. We moved there when I was 13, and then I went to public school for a little while, and then my parents put me in a Christian school. I didn't acclimate well to the city life, and so they took me into a smaller school, and my school, Philadelphia Montgomery Christian Academy, Philmont Christian Academy, is where I went to high school, and I excelled athletically there in a smaller situation. That's what I needed. I've always needed sports, I guess, to kind of complete me a little bit. I think that's a good definition of it. And through that, I met my high school teammates, about three guys from the basketball and baseball teams and soccer teams, went to Messiah College, which is near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and that's where I ended up. Played basketball there for 3 years. Tinkered with being a two-sport athlete there, but I didn't. I wasn't a great student. I always tell people my first year of college, I got a 3.7 GPA, 1.9 to first semester, 1.8 to second semester. The light switch flipped on from a dedication and discipline standpoint, and I ended up being Dean's List my junior and senior year, but I didn't end up playing baseball. But anyway, through that, I met a guy named Greg Mace, who passed away, unfortunately, this year, who you knew in Harrisburg, a legendary ABC sportscaster in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I did an internship with him my senior year, and that was really the defining moment of Parney ending up being in, well, back then, I guess it was Todd Parnell still. I was a little bit party, but that was the defining moment. Meeting Greg Mace was the defining moment of me getting in a position where I would meet people that would start my career in sports.
So aside from playing sports and trying to figure out how to be a passing student in college, what was college at Messiah College Parney?
I loved it.
Todd Parnell, like,
I loved it. I mean, I was a little bit like I am now. You know, Messiah College is exactly what it sounds like. I mean, it's a Christian school, a lot of rules, a lot of regulations. Let's just say that I still had my fun, but within the confines of what the school stood for and still stands for. And I loved that. I needed that kind of structure. If I would have gone to Penn State, or if I would have gone to University of North Carolina, although I applied there, they didn't take me. You know, if I would have gone to one of those schools at that juncture of my life, Trey, I don't know if I would have had the discipline to get it done. So I'm forever grateful to Messiah College. And you know me, I'm all about people. And the people that I met there that really had an effect on my life, a guy named Jack Cole, who recently retired as the athletic director, was actually the assistant basketball coach there. And Coach Cole had a profound impact on my life because he saw that I had my flaws, and he saw that I wasn't particularly a great student, not because I didn't have the intellect, because I didn't work hard enough at the academics. And he pushed me. And on my graduation day, he gave me a hug and he said, you are now and probably forever will be the biggest miracle of my academic career. especially since I was received accolades academically those last 2 years. So Coach Cole was a big part of my life. And he introduced me to Greg Mace that I mentioned. And that's how I got that internship. And through Greg Mace, ironically, Trey, I met some people that used to work here for the Richmond Braves. A guy named Rick Redd and a guy named Todd Vanderwoody that I got to know. They were running the Harrisburg Senators at the time. Ironically, Todd Vanderwoody interviewed me for an internship, but I ended up getting it with Greg Mace instead, and I was a terrible. We've been great friends for a long time since my baseball career started. He told me I was a terrible interview back in those days. He probably wouldn't have hired me anyway. But I think I've always think about how ironic in life so many things are circular, and that was a circular moment. Rick Redd actually came here 2 summers ago, and we got to spend time here in my office, and that was kind of neat. So, you know, I'm all about people. I'm all about that's what life is to me. It's about the relationships and the people that you come in with, and that's the most important thing. Everything else is just details.
I know what you mean about struggling at first academically and then having to come back strong. I had a similar thing. I went to college. It didn't go great first time. They asked me to leave, finally. I went out into the real world for a little bit and came back, and I was a great student after that. Changed my work ethic going forward, and I carried that and tried to carry that into what I've done.
You do. You have a great work ethic.
I appreciate
it's funny.
That.
My dad used to always, we'd be driving down the road, and you'd see like somebody working hard, whether it be somebody digging a ditch or somebody, you go past a cemetery, and they were digging a grave or whatever. My dad would say, this is why you need to go to college. Do you want to do this every day of your life? You know, and I think about that too. There's so many hardworking people that get up every day and have to do very strenuous things. And I get to come to a minor league ballpark, and I've never tried, even during the darkest of days, I never try to view this as anything other than a pleasure and an honor being here, especially with the people like you that I'm here with on a daily basis. I mean, it's really an honor to be in this industry, and it's really an honor to be here in Richmond specifically.
It is quite a blessing. And a year and a half into being here, I look around and see that, you know, try to remind myself of it all the time. But it's not too hard to do. And 10 years into working around minor league baseball, it's a pretty cool gig.
Yep.
How did you end up getting into your first baseball job?
Well, a guy named Chuck Domino called Todd Vanderwoody and Rick Redd. I think at that point, it might have just been Todd Vanderwoody. They connected me to this guy named Chuck Domino, and I drove to Philadelphia and met him at an airport hotel in the lobby. I was one of two people to interview for the job, Trey, and I came in second place. And he hired a guy named Marty Owens, sight unseen. So he always tells a story. This is a Chuck Domino story staple right here. He always says that he had two candidates, one interviewed for the job in person, one he never met. He hired the person that never met, Marty Owens, and Marty was supposed to drive to Reading, Pennsylvania to start. Chuck called me and said, hey, you were good, but you came in second place. I'm going to hire this other guy on recommendation of a guy named Bob Beban, who I don't know if you've ever heard that name. He used to run the team in Eugene, Oregon. Anyway, back in those days, there were no cell phones. Marty Owens didn't show up on time, and Chuck spent a couple of days trying to find Marty Owens. Finally, this tells you how smart Chucky is. He waited 2 days to call Marty Owens' house in Wichita, Kansas, and Marty Owens was at the kitchen table. He changed his mind in Indianapolis and came back to Wichita to be with his girlfriend at the time. So anytime anything good ever happens to me or we win awards, I always thank Marty Owens for turning around in Indianapolis and going back to Wichita. And then that became the relationship with Chuck and Redding, the one that's been very, very strong for three going on 4 decades now. We had a small 5-person front office staff. I'd never forget in Reading my first year, we drew 200,000 fans. And when we crossed the 200,000 fan mark, we went out and celebrated like we'd won game 7 of the World Series. And you've worked a lot of games in Reading through the years. My last year there in 1996, I remember bringing Chuck and Scott Hunsicker, who's now the general manager of the Reading Fightins, into my office because I'm the one that had all the attendance figures. And I said, look at this, guys. Today's May 31st, and we just eclipsed 200,000 fans on May 31st. You guys remember 6 years ago when we partied like the Rolling Stones in the 70s when we crossed 200,000 on the last day of the season? That's how good we were rolling there, and I learned so much there and then went on to Kannapolis, which was a real honor because it was the toughest job I ever had, but it was really neat living and working 8 miles from Locust where I grew up. Not many people, you're getting that opportunity kind of right now, and it's not 8 miles, but not many people in baseball get the opportunity where they can do that.
Now for me, that's been life-altering, being a couple hours from all of my family down in the Hampton Roads area or up in the D.C. area, and just being in a place.
I crushed our pass list when I was in Kannapolis.
Cause like, I'm sure.
You know, even people that beat me up in third grade would try to get free tickets off of me, you know, but it was a cool experience, and it was was an experience. I didn't mean to interrupt you. It was an experience that I learned a lot as a minor league baseball executive because things were so tough there. You know, I learned how to be in the shadows of a big city of Charlotte, to still, for lack of a better word, infiltrate the media there. I was on Paul Shad morning show a lot on Cat Country in Charlotte, which was a very popular morning radio show. And that's kind of when the personality of Parney started to develop a little bit more.
Now, at that point, the team in Kannapolis was still the Piedmont Bullweevils.
My first year, they were the Piedmont Bullweevils.
You got rid of that after a year.
No, it was like maybe 3 years, and then we became the Kannapolis Intimidators. So I think it was 4 seasons I was there with the Piedmont Bullweevils. But we were responsible for coming up with the phrase unbullweevable, which is something that I really want to make sure that everybody knows was my responsibility. And we had a lot of fun with unbullweevable. And then we had a little bit of a dream one night about, hey, what if we got some NASCAR people involved in our team, right?
Right in the heart of it.
You're a big NASCAR fan, Trey. And so we met some people, and long story short, Larry Hedrick was the owner of our team. At that time, he was the owner of the 41 Kodiak car that had a bunch of drivers, but Steve Grissom was probably the most renowned one. And Larry contacted Bruton Smith and Dale Earnhardt, and Bruton Smith and Dale Earnhardt ended up becoming owners of our team, and we changed the name to the Kannapolis Intimidators at that point.
So Bruton Smith is involved with Charlotte Motor Speedway, right?
Speedway Motorsports.
Several tracks, right? Right. Promoting Mind and NASCAR, right?
Well, and Humpy Wheeler, who was the voice of one of the cars in whatever the name of that movie was.
Cars.
Larry the Cable Guy. It was Cars.
It was Cars.
You know, I always thought it was cool that Humpy had his own car in Cars and had the voice of one of the cars. So you know, and being so close to those guys, and they were Barnum and Bailey of NASCAR at Charlotte Motor Speedway. So we learned a lot from them, and we did a lot of things that just made a lot of sense. For example, there was a couple week period in Charlotte where they had the sprint race, the bonus race, I forget what it's called, and then the Coca-Cola 600. So 2 weeks straight, people were just all over Charlotte, North Carolina. Well, in the past, the management of the team would try to go on a 14-day road trip. And I got there, and I'm like, that makes no sense at all. And they said, well, there's no hotels. I said, we can find 20 hotel rooms somewhere. These people that are in the campgrounds, these people are in the hotels, they go to the track to watch practice. They go to the track to watch this, that, and the other thing. What are they doing at night? And let's get some NASCAR involvement. And then as we got Dale Earnhardt involved and Bruton Smith involved, is when we really saw a lot of interconnectivity with the NASCAR community, which then led us to a lot of, we were never like crazy successful as it pertained to crowds. I mean, I think our biggest year was like 170,000 or something like that, but it was the biggest they ever had. Now this year they have a new ballpark in Kannapolis, and I was excited to see what would happen there because the town's really growing. But that was absolutely the toughest job I ever had. But I also believe that in terms of me individually, I probably wouldn't be the person that I am or the professional that I am without Kannapolis having, because it made me grow because I had no other choice.
Kannapolis being Dale Earnhardt's hometown, the town he grew up in, how much did you interact with him when you were operating that team? And really, what was it like to be in a room with him? Because there's certain people that they say in this world that the air changes when they walk into a room. I know Marty Smith over on ESPN says that about guys like Earnhardt, Michael Jordan. It's just like being in a different place.
Marty Smith's really cool, by the way.
He's great.
And Ryan McGee. Let's not leave Ryan out.
Yeah. They go hand in hand,
yeah,
right?
And McGee always wears a minor league baseball hat.
So he wore the Flying Squirrels hat on their show on the SEC Network.
He did.
A few weeks ago.
And he wore a Biscuits hat for our brothers down in Montgomery, too. So what was that like? It was kind of like hanging out with like a superhero. The day that Dale Earnhardt called me Parney for the first time is and will forever be one of the coolest days of my life.
Yeah.
You know, just being able to drive into the Garage Mahal and, you know, have clearance and, you know, go have meetings and all that kind of stuff for a little country boy from Locust, North Carolina, you know, and then to know that Dale Earnhardt knew what my name was a pretty cool experience. But, I mean, he was as down to earth as me and you and whoever else we bump into in this office. He was very, very much a down to earth person. Always asked me every time he saw me. Always asked me about my wife and kids. I was married at the time. He got up at 4:30 every morning and went down to the local gas station and had coffee with the farmers. Just a normal guy. And that's what made it so hard on February 18th, 2001, because he was a superhero. Dale Earnhardt doesn't die, ever, from anything.
Yeah.
And for it to happen on the last lap of the Daytona 500 was life-changing, Trey, for a lot of people, including myself, because then that kind of set the tone for the next next move when the next opportunity had come up. I was so in awe of the whole Earnhardt thing and enjoyed being attached to that so much that I don't know if I ever would have left Kannapolis as long as Dale Earnhardt was involved with the baseball team. So, and then there's thousands of others whose lives changed because of that too. But it was unbelievable. Being at the public funeral, we had a private funeral, or not, we had a public funeral at a church, then they had a public funeral at the ballpark, over 6,000 people. I went out with somebody and walked through the parking lot and counted 37 different states on license plates. I wish nobody went through that, because I wish he was still with us, but it was a surreal experience. So to answer your question, being around him, it was two different things. It was very normal and very everyday, and then it was surreal. Like, you still walked away and went, holy smokes, Dale Earnhardt just called me Parney.
Yeah.
And back then, Dale Earnhardt was Dale Earnhardt Sr., or Big E, or whatever you called him. And then Junior was just, the little son off to the side that was, the party guy.
We would come up to Richmond, what was then RIR, now Richmond Raceway. We would come up every spring and fall race weekend. We'd go to all four of those events. You would always see the drivers do the parade lap around the track. The whole energy in the place changed when certain guys went by. But it was always very different. It was this mix of boos and cheers. You loved him or you hated him with Dale Earnhardt when he went by. And I remember thinking, like, there's down there, this tiny down there on the track, there's Dale Earnhardt. But the one time I ever got close was they had going down into turn one, there's a pedestrian tunnel at Richmond Raceway, and we sat on the front stretch and parked over near Laburnum. So after a race, walking by, we had to go right past where a lot of the drivers walked, and we'd stop it, and I was probably 9 years old or something like that. And one time on the way to, I'm guessing, the helicopter pad that's out there, he walked by. And that's, just maybe 5 feet away. And I remember that. It was the closest I ever got to a guy who was like superhero to people who grew up watching and being around that time.
Yeah, it was like walking past Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Like seriously, like, it was just, he was a superstar. And so I learned a lot from that, not only in that way, but just how he, the merchandise, like, Dale Earnhardt changed NASCAR in a lot of ways, but the merchandising of it was one of the main ways that he changed it. And creating stuff, and by stuff, I mean, like, the rivalry he had with Jeff Gordon was great for NASCAR. It was great for racing. It was also great for sales.
Oh, yeah.
And so, watching that, even kind of up close and personal, and being able to turn that over into the baseball world has been something that's been beneficial as well. And the same can be said for the relationship that I had in Altoona with Jerome Bettis and Mario Lemieux. Like, watching the crossover of sports and being able to figure out how to utilize that and cross over fan bases is something we do here in Richmond still to this day.
At AAA, we've seen breakdowns, lockouts, and full stops. 118 years of them. So trust us when we say we can get through anything by navigating it together. See how we're helping to keep you safe. Visit AAA.com/keepmoving.
Back to the Funville Nine, driven by AAA, the official podcast of the Richmond Flying Squirrels.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit. We talked about your time in Kannapolis, North Carolina.
I see what you did there, Trey.
Yeah. Talked about your time in Kannapolis with the Boll Weevils and then the Intimidators. Where'd you go from there?
From there, I went to Altoona, Pennsylvania, where you have matriculated before. One of the situations, Chuck Greenberg called me and said, hey, people have been telling me your name. I'm looking for a GM in Altoona. And as soon as he said that, I said, Altoona, Pennsylvania? And he said, yes. And I said, I live in my dream house on Lake Norman near my hometown. I am not remotely interested. And he said, okay. Well, I've interviewed like 30 people, and everybody speaks very high of you. Would you mind me asking your opinion of some of these people? And I said, sure, but there's no way in heck I'm moving to Altoona, Pennsylvania. I gave him my honest opinion on various people throughout the list, and then he got to the end, and he's like, you're my guy. And I'm like, I'm not interested. And he said, go home and talk about it. We'll talk terms. I want you to bring your wife, again, I was married at the time, up here. And he was really smart. We went up there. Chuck hardly said anything to me and spent 2 days working on Kelly because he knew the gig, right?
Mm-hmm.
And long story short, we ended up moving there and had a great time there in Altoona. Both of my kids really grew up in the ballpark there in Altoona. Beautiful ballpark, as you know, Trey.
Oh,
wonderful,
yeah.
Wonderful group of people in Altoona. Their GM that you worked with, Derek Martin, actually was one of our group sales reps there. And a lot of people that worked for us in Altoona went on to become general managers and other executive titles in other places around around not only baseball but sports. So it was a good time there.
While you were with Altoona, you know, the mid to late, coming up the mid-2000s, it was there that Altoona was starting to become pretty well known for doing some wacky and weird promotions,
right,
standing out in that sense. And I think that that's become one of the staples of what you're known for, I would say, right?
Yeah, a little bit of P.T. Barnum type stuff, right? And, you know, I just think that our job is to really make memories for people, and you do that in a lot of different ways. And I think that there is no such thing as a bad idea, and we're in the memory-making business. All those phraseologies that you've heard a million times around here, Trey, and I just think when you can do something that's different, when you can do something that's fun, and especially when you can do something that's impactful, you have to do it 10 times out of 10. And we haven't hit home runs on all of them. We've made some mistakes through the years, but you know, I'm happy that we're known for as many of the good promotions as we are.
What's one thing that comes to mind that you think of when you look back at your time in Altoona? One story that stands out to you? I'm sure that there are plenty that might not be the best for this medium, but
No, we had there were so many fun players and so many great relationships that came through there. Managers, Del Swain was our manager the first year. He went on to be the manager of the Chicago Cubs, was the third base coach of the 2004 world champion Boston Red Sox. But again, with me, Trey, it goes back to people and, you know, just the people of Altoona. I mean, I'm not talking about famous people. I mean, just people of Altoona and the relationships. The thing I remember about Altoona that I'm proudest of, one of the things I'm proud of, is we used to have these survey cards that were basically complaint cards that they would have at the customer service booth. I don't know if they still have them or not.
Oh, they do.
And people would come to the customer service booth and they would fill out their complaint. And when I got there, I said, all right, I want those on my desk in at the seventh inning stretch. And if there's any after that, put them on my desk before you leave. And they said, why? I said, because I want to deal with them right then and there in the moment. There wasn't a ton of cell phones back then, but some people had cell phones, right? I mean, 2006, yeah, people had cell phones. But it wasn't like today where you never leave your cell phone. So I would call people from my desk in the eighth inning. Sometimes they would put their home, like hardly anybody has a home number now, right? But back then, a lot of people still did. So my point was, when people got home from complaining about the price of a hot dog going up 10 cents, they had a message for me. And that became what our organization was known for, was not hiding from criticism, not hiding from not being perfect. And I think that we've brought that. We don't have, you know, cards here that people can fill out, but I think our accessibility here is amongst the best, and that we literally stand out by the gate and thank people on the way in. We thank people on the way out. And that also gives people a forum, if they're not pleased with everything that we're doing, that they have the accessibility to say it. The thing that would upset me is if people would not come back here because of something that we did or are not doing, and we didn't have a chance to correct it. So that's why the accessibility thing is so important. The other thing that I remember about Altoona that was so impressive is, I don't know if you ever went there, but there was a watering hole in Altoona called a Hotel Belmar.
It's the first place I met you, actually.
I spent a lot of time at the Hotel Belmar.
Oh, yeah.
Two things real quick. Nate McLouth was a Gold Glove center fielder for the Pittsburgh Pirates. He went on to play for the Atlanta Braves. Our listeners here might remember him from the Atlanta Braves. McLouth walked into my office on a Friday afternoon in the fall, and I'm like, what the heck are you doing here? He had just been named a Gold Glove for the Pirates, and mm-hmm. Well, he was a big Michigan fan, and Penn State was playing Michigan the next day, and him and his buddy came into town and surprised me. So we went out to the Hotel Belmar later on that night, about 9 o'clock, and we're sitting there, and I mean, he's a Gold Glove winner for a major league team that's 93 miles from Altoona, Pennsylvania, so people are recognizing him.
Oh, yeah.
And this guy comes up at about 11:30 and says, Nate, it would make my life if a Gold Glover like you would go out and have a catch with me in the parking lot. And he looked at me, and I'm like, yeah, do it. What could happen? It's a good story. So about 10 minutes later, he comes back in, and he's like, dude, that guy was throwing BBs at me. And he goes, and he lofted one over my head, and it knocked a window out in somebody's car. So I had to tell the owner, that there was. And then the last thing about the Hotel Belmar is the back cooler, we used to go back there away from the crowds on busy nights, and me and the owner and a couple other people would sit in the back and have a beer and talk. Well, one night in the back cooler, we noticed somehow we had four of the five starting pitchers of the Pittsburgh Pirate rotation in the back cooler with us, sitting on kegs drinking beers. Zach Duke,
yeah. 2004 in Altoona.
Paul Mahalam, Tom Gorzolani, Matt Capps was with us that night too. So welcome to the name dropping portion of our show, folks.
Yeah, that would take up the rest of the time that we've got. So
founded in 1996, SICOM is an award-winning IT systems integrator headquartered in Richmond with offices throughout Virginia. Their focus is on mid-Atlantic companies, healthcare organizations, educational institutions, and governments looking to improve their technology return on investment. SICOM is a trusted partner to deliver a range of IT solutions solutions and services that keep companies connected. Named as one of the top workplaces in Richmond, SICOM is also the employer of choice for the best talent in the region and are committed to providing outstanding and memorable service.
Back to the Funville Nine, driven by AAA, the official podcast of the Richmond Flying Squirrels.
We're talking with Flying Squirrels VP and COO Parney. This is the inaugural episode of the Funville Nine.
Funville Nine.
The official podcast of the Richmond Flying Squirrels, driven by AAA, and we're thankful for our friends at AAA.
Absolutely.
For jumping on board people. And helping out with this.
Yeah, they're great people, and one of the things, we miss our fans, but we also miss our partners. And so, Trey, this is a great forum for us to thank our friends at AAA and the many, many, many great partners that the Flying Squirrels have had, not only in 2020 when we're yet to be playing, but also the first 10 years of the franchise. We couldn't do all that we do without them.
Absolutely. They're an important part of us being able to do what we do here. So we're grateful for everyone who has jumped on and become a part of this organization, and especially today, thankful for everyone who's jumped on to be a part of this brand new podcast. You mentioned those comment cards, the customer service in Altoona. I got two in one day one time. And one of them said, please tell the radio guy to say the score more, which is in broadcast play-by-play land. That's you can't say the score too much.
Right.
You know, people listen on the radio, they can't see. And the second card that night said, tell the radio guy he says the score too much, we get it. And that was a lesson for me, and you just can't always please everyone.
Right.
So you can try.
Right. I probably know the people that probably wrote those.
Yeah, Altoona is a much smaller place than Richmond. Richmond feels like a very tight-knit community, and it is.
Well, just think about all the restaurants that we have to choose from Richmond compared to the restaurants we had to choose from when both of us lived in Altoona. You know, I mean, it was like, where are you going to eat? Well, you had your Wednesday night place, your Thursday night place, your Saturday night place. Here, you could do that 30, 40, 50 different weeks and not hit the same spot.
When I first moved back to Virginia, when I came to Richmond, I posted a tweet and said, everyone in Richmond, send me your Richmond food suggestions. I want to hit as many local spots. I haven't gotten through the list yet.
Yeah.
I think there's 80-something just on the suggested list.
Right.
So I've got a ways to go, and I had to slow down a little bit because I was going to need to start poking new holes in my belt. So you were with Altoona through most of the first decade of the 2000s. You were as the general manager with the Altoona Curve. That time came to an end. I know the team got sold. What did you do after you left Altoona?
Well, when we were in Altoona, Chuck Greenberg was the owner, and he wanted to buy other teams. He wanted to build a little bit of a quote-unquote empire. So we bought a team in New Jersey, the New Jersey Cardinals, and we moved it to State College, built the Medler Field at Lebrano Park, where the State College Spikes and Penn State
at
University
Penn State,
play.
Yeah.
So when I got here, I'd already had experience at working with a NCAA Division I baseball team in a minor league facility. I'd done that already at Penn State, so that was helpful. And then we also bought the Myrtle Beach Pelicans. So we actually at one point ran three different teams at the same time, and that was an awful lot. And then on or around June 30th in 2009, Chuck Domino called me out of the blue and said, hey, Lou DeBell is going to move his team from Norwich to Richmond, most likely. And he hired me to put together the front office and be the consultant or chief executive to put everything together. I told him that you would come with us, and I knew Lou from Altoona. And I said, wait a second, you told him already? And he said, yeah, I told him you would come with us. So I literally moved here sight unseen because I trusted Chuck Domino. I had a friendship with Lou DiBella, not nearly as close as Lou and I are now. I consider Lou one of my best friends in the world. And we came down here, and it was just me and Chuck. I came down on August 2nd, 2009. Nobody knew who we were. We were just two strangers in a town that I'd never been to before. And we walked into the Diamond, and I looked at Chuck, and I said, you just ruined my life. And he looked at me with full confidence and said, don't worry, this is going to be the best thing that's ever happened to you and me and a lot of other people. And he was right. And this has been my favorite city to live in. This has been my favorite team to work for. And it's just, I can't talk about it enough, Trey. It's been wonderful, and I'm looking forward because I don't think we've even reached the heights that we're going to reach at some point.
Feels like we're growing and improving all the time with our ways of connecting with our community and running the show. I know what you mean there. The first time that you came into the Diamond, you mentioned a minute ago, you're walking around. You said to Chuck, you just ruined my life, but what were you seeing? What was left at that point? Because the ballpark had been unoccupied for a year.
Have you ever been into a house that nobody's lived in for a year and a half, for a year or 2 years or whatever? Just there's no furniture. The ceiling tiles are either stained or they're falling down. There's trash that people swept but didn't move. You know, I mean, just everywhere you looked. And then we went up. I'll never forget this. We went up into the first base lower understand. My shoes stuck to the floor. And I was just like, come on, bro. Like, Chuck, seriously? And he was like, don't worry. Everything's going to be fine. And Chuck is a magician at real estate and facilities in a ballpark and being able to figure out what would work. And he's legendary at that. So that's, it was fun. We drank out of a fire hose for 5.5 months. As you know, Trey, when people start a franchise, they usually give themselves 18 to 24 months to get ready. We did it in 5.5 months. And that'll always, for all of us that were here, and there's still some here, Benny Rothrock, Anthony Opperman, Ben Terry, Chuck, Faith, those of us that were here that first year and the people that have gone on to great successes other places, I think we'll always be proud of that because people don't understand all that we accomplished in 5.5 months. We were a melting pot. You know, Bill Perpierniak and Tom Denlinger, who's gone on to the Augusta Green Jackets now, they brought in Daytona philosophies. They ran the team in Daytona. Ben had been with me in State College, Myrtle Beach, and Altoona. Somebody I'm really proud of has gone from an intern in Altoona to the general manager of the Squirrels. So there's just a ton. We could probably write a book on that first year if we ever wanted to, but there would probably be some incendiary chapters for certain people.
Before opening day, before the players are here, before baseball happens, what was the most difficult thing about trying to get this thing off the ground and get it started?
I mean, the facility itself, just cleanliness, changes. We put all new seats in. We put cup holders in. All those things that went from, you know, the metal benches that were here for all those years to upgrading it to a ballpark that people could enjoy a long stay, a three-hour game or whatever. And then just developing all the relationships with the vendors. And we had to hire everybody. We had to hire full-time people. We had to hire part-time people. I mean, just we had to make pricing. We had to get computers, everything, phones. We didn't have phone lines, you know. So the short answer to your question is absolutely everything. And we did that while basically being the first relationship after a divorce.
Yeah.
So the Richmond Braves divorced Richmond, and then we were the first relationship, and we're coming in and saying, we're going to do this, and we're going to be the Flying Squirrels. You know, just trying to get people to not discount us because we were so different than what they had seen before. And I can't tell you, Trey, how many times I said to people, just trust us, just trust us, just trust us, just trust us. And then opening night, people were like, whoa, is this what it's like? And then the next night, there was 9,000 people here the next night, and people were like, wow. And then the next night, there was 9,000 people. And then we had Sunday afternoon, we had 9,000. Because of some key decisions that we made, and Chuck gets so much credit for a lot of those, like putting the big banners over the top 12 rows or so to make the capacity 9,560 instead of 12,000. That created a classic business supply and demand flow. You know, we sold out opening night 23 days before opening night. So people were used to coming up to the Diamond for a Richmond Braves game and just buying a ticket. So they were coming in 7 days ahead of time going, hey, I need to get my box seats for opening day. And we were like, that was 16 days ago when those were sold out. So that really helped us. We became a hotter thing every 24 hours. And the first year was great. The crew that we had just never let up on the gas pedal.
You mentioned the name. I wanted to ask you about that. Pull back the curtain some about how the Flying Squirrels name came to be. Because, you know, coming from what was a pretty traditional baseball sense, the Richmond Braves were here. They had the name of the parent club. They had been named the Richmond Braves ever since going back to when the Virginians, when that shift happened to become the Richmond Braves. At that time, there weren't as many weird, wacky minor league baseball team names as there are today. Flying Squirrels at the time seemed to be, if you look at the team names today, it seems pretty down the middle, especially because of what's become associated with that branding. But at that time, it seemed way, way out there.
Chuck and I used to love it. We'd go to bars and restaurants, and again, nobody really knew who we were. So we'd be sitting there, and people would be like, I wonder who those jerks are that are bringing baseball back to Richmond, because that name is the stupid. I would never set foot in the Diamond ever again. Or I would go give a speech, and I was on the speaking circuit like you think I'm on it now. I mean, I was literally breakfast, lunch, and dinner every single day of the week, and even on the weekends. And there was always be somebody that would wait and say, you know, you seem like a nice guy. You seem like you're really excited about what you're doing, but I'm not coming to games because that's just a stupid, silly name that just doesn't represent our distinguished city. And then I would see those same people in May and June of the first year with it, because I would say to them, you'll come to our games because your kids and your grandkids are going to want you to come to our games. And it worked every single time because Flying Squirrel's name was fun, it was different, and it was impactful in a bunch of different ways. And that was, again, the three core principles that we decided on. It just caught on, and people, after the first little bit, would say to me, you know, I hated it when it first came out, but now I couldn't think of it being anything else. And we've become such an important part of the fabric of this community that I think it fits perfectly. There had been no other team named Flying Squirrels in the history of the world, by the way. Like, we were the
very first. Of course, yeah. So how did the name come to be? I know that you guys partnered with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and you took names.
Name the team contest.
Yeah.
Chuck and I were incognito over at the Times-Dispatch, and we walked into basically a holding room, because they didn't want people to know that the baseball team guys were there. And he saw this thing on the wall, and it was animals indigenous to the Commonwealth of Virginia. And it's now, Trey, it's in our copy machine room. And he looked at that, and he goes, look, Flying Squirrels. He goes, that's perfect. And I said, are you out of your mind? And he said, no, that's perfect. We started researching it, and then we were hoping someone would nominate Flying Squirrels, and they did in the contest. And then from that point on, we just pushed it as hard as we could. The way we had the final choice set up, it wasn't going to be the most popular one. We were using the fans for like a barometer of what they wanted, and Flying Squirrels was actually second. But to be honest with you, I don't even remember who was number one at this point. I mean, Flying Squirrels has become such a part of who we are that I don't even remember who was second. But it was a very controversial process. It was a very controversial name. The day that it became okay, though, in my book, was when we brought Nutsy out at the Bird Theater and we showed off our uniforms. James Ferrier, at that time, was an all-pro linebacker from Pittsburgh Steelers. He came and he was wearing his Flying Squirrels hat, and his nickname is Potsy. Potsy used to be on ESPN all the time wearing Flying Squirrels hats all the time. And that was really helpful to us, you know, because he's a hometown guy, and people went, well, if James Ferrier's wearing that stuff, that must be pretty good. He just loved it, and has been a great friend to me personally in the organization for forever. He lives in LA now. But anyway, that day at the Bird Theater stands out to me as a day that was really, really important.
I remember the name came out thinking, what are they doing? What in the world? Because I grew up close to here, and my initial thought was probably along the same lines of what a lot of people said to you. Not that I'm never going to go, or not that it's not going to work, but I was just remember thinking, that's a little bit weird.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like a sports team, you know?
One of the things that Chuck taught me for years and years is if you're going to do something, you got to really have the courage and believe in it and believe that you're doing the right thing, especially from the standpoint of something like this, like naming a team or changing a ballpark or whatever. And we really stressed that. Like, we had to believe it. I mean, we had to act differently about it. When we named the team the Flying Squirrels, I came out at the press conference wearing head-to-toe black leotards, which I could not pull off now. I was skinnier back then, with a red cape and a Flying Squirrels mask on. And somebody said, are you going to take the mask off for the TV interviews? I go, no, that's part of the whole thing. Like, I'm a human Flying Squirrel. And that really started setting us apart. You know, that people are like, whoa, these guys are different. They are fun. Like, this guy's doing an interview in a black leotard with a red cape on with a mask. So I think we had the right people at the right place at the right time with the right ownership group. And it's been wonderful.
The organization has become known for so much more than baseball. Baseball is a central part of what we do. You come to the ballpark, you're here watching a baseball game. If you break it down, that's the simplest way to put it out there. But the organization's become known for so much more. It's so visible in the community. There are a lot of people who think of us as much more than just a team with nine guys in the field hitting the ball around. That starts, I think, with the three pillars that you guys founded this franchise on. Can you talk about those some?
One of the cool things about coming here and Lou asking us to come here was we could have done anything we wanted to. And I remember very succinctly Chuck sitting at the Holiday Inn Crossroads right over there on Staples Mill. And we're sitting at the bar having a Bud Light bottle. And we wrote on the paper, what do we want to be? And I just remember saying stuff like fun and different and impactful and blah, blah, blah. And we ended up with those three. Have fun every day, because people don't want to come to a place like ours and see miserable people working. They want to see fun, people having fun. Fans cannot have fun unless me and you and our teammates are having fun working. Like, we're putting on the show, and we have to have fun. Number two, different. You know, people laugh at me all the time about my pants. Well, that's all part of it. That's part of being Parney. That's part of the Flying Squirrels. That's interconnected to who the Flying Squirrels brand is Parney's pants and other things. You know, we have to be different. We got to have an insatiable appetite for success for whatever we're doing. Our appetites have to be insatiable. The most important one, which, you know, we always talk about not being just a baseball team, being 12 months a year. Most important thing is being impactful. So when people ask us to do stuff, we always say we like to start at yes and go backwards from there, because so many people in life just start saying no right away. I think it's really, 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 really important to be as involved as many things as you possibly can, both personally and professionally. So having fun, being different, and being impactful every single day is what has made the Flying Squirrels not just a baseball team, but hopefully one of the most well-known businesses in this community.
We've now got 10 seasons under our belt here. You just finished up year 10 last year. Over the last 10 years, are there any moments that stand out to you as where you kind of say that this is a Richmond Flying Squirrels moment?
Obviously the All-Star game, because we took it to such a different level. You know, when the Arizona firefighters were killed a few years ago, I believe it was 17 of them, the crew that got caught in that horrific fire, and we within 24 I went home and I was watching it on TV, and within 24 hours we got together, Henrico, Hanover, Chesterfield, and Richmond firefighters, and actually did a bell ringing exercise on the field before a game. It's stuff like that, you know, being in the moment for community moments that our entire country is working on, and we're obviously in one right now. That's what become Flying Squirrels moments to me. Being aware of what's going on and using the ballpark to be a gathering place and to be a place where people heal. You know, we're not playing baseball games right now, but this afternoon, earlier today, we presented the Richmond Public School District's Scholar Athlete of the Year Awards, School Superintendent Cameras and some athletic directors, and the families that were here. The ballpark was empty, but those families and those student athletes will never forget that moment. So the moments that become memories of a lifetime, that is a Flying Squirrels moment.
On the field, baseball-wise, what are some of the baseball moments? I know during the games, you don't really get to see a lot of the game that's going on the field, but is there anything that stands out?
The moments are afterwards, you know, the players that got called up to the big leagues, the day that Jarrett Parker and Matt Duffy got called up right up to the Giants, right from the tunnel right behind where you and I are sitting, and the limo pulled in, and they thought they were getting traded because we had literally pulled them off the bus that morning, and it was the trade deadline, so they're like, oh, man, we're going to get traded this afternoon. No, they were going to the big leagues, and we didn't tell them, they didn't know it. Stuff like that. You know, the guys, the families that are here when the guys get called up to AAA or they get called up to the big leagues. People like Lee Smith being here when he gets put into the Hall of Fame and you know, just talking to him about what that means to get the phone call and the hot stove banquets and all those things. That's what means the most to me.
As we march forward into the second decade of Flying Squirrels baseball, whenever baseball games do start happening again, and they will, this place is going to be packed and it's going to be electric. But what do you want to see out of the second set of 10 seasons of Flying Squirrels baseball?
Well, right now, just people, man. I mean, we miss people. We're people, and we miss them. I think just a continued growth in the community as far as our impactfulness, number one. Number two, that elusive ballpark would be nice in the next 10 years, obviously. We always tell Chuck, you know, you told me we'd have it in the second year, and here we are sitting here in year 11. And I just think being a part of the transformation that happens on this side of town, which, by the way, I feel like we have been. I think if the Flying Squirrels had not been drawing 400,000 fans a year, and VCU obviously has had a hand in that too, Scott's Addition probably wouldn't be as successful as it is. And Scott's Addition, when I moved here 10 years ago, was an area where people said, don't go over there, you know, and now it's booming. You know, it's one of the number one millennial spots, not only in Virginia and Richmond, but in the country. I think you're going to see more and more of that. And I think having the Flying Squirrels play a role in all those things is what I would hope would happen.
Well, we're going to need to wrap this up because we have gone really, really long. We will do this again. There will be another episode at some point down the road where we can get into several more topics. But this has been a fun kind of look at how you got to where you're at, how the organization got to where it's at today.
Sorry for all the editing, Trey. We're going to have to do a lot of editing on this, but I enjoyed it. I really want to tell everybody that we miss you profusely. Make sure that our fans are staying in touch with us. Follow the Squirrels on all of our social media channels. And, you know, every day we wake up and we live life with hope and we want to hear good news. But if we don't hear good news, we'll just keep controlling the controllable every single day. And that is, the controllables are our attitudes and our efforts.
Baseball will be back. And in the meantime, until it's not, as we wait for it to come back, the Flying Squirrels are going to be here. Everybody, y'all know where to find us. And we'll be here ready for baseball when it's time for that to start happening again. Parnie, thanks so much for being our guest on the inaugural episode, which might end up being the inaugural first two episodes.
Sorry about that.
Of the Funville 9, driven by AAA, the official Flying Squirrels podcast. We'll be back with another episode next week. Until then, you can stay in touch with us on Facebook at Flying Squirrels Baseball, on Twitter at Go Squirrels, Instagram at Go Squirrels as well. I'm on Twitter at TreyWilson757. Shoot us a note. You can find Parney, of course, at TweetParney. And for all the information related to what's going on with the Flying Squirrels, you can head to our official website at SquirrelsBaseball.com. We will talk to you next week on the next episode of the Funville 9 podcast, driven by AAA.
You've been listening to the Funville 9, driven by AAA, the official podcast of the Richmond Flying Squirrels.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.